This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a Crowd podcast.
Rosenberg,
H-Bomb,
Sugar Ray,
Pam and John,
Brando,
The King and I,
and The Catcher in the Rye.
What a book.
So good.
Hello again and welcome to episode 21 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the podcast that finds out everything that mattered in the post-war world and everything that explains the way the world is now. All dictated by Billy Joel's imagination and ability to make major global events rhyme. I'm Tom Fordyce.
I'm Katie Puckrick.
Katie, we go where no other podcast goes. No other podcast has Billy.
Nope. And today we are talking about, I would say, the original young adult novel by J.D. Salinger, Catcher in the Rye. So is this a book that you have some familiarity with, Tom?
Katie, I read Catcher in the Rye the first time about 25 years ago, and I reread it for this show.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes when there's a book you've really enjoyed in your younger years, and when you reread it, you see not only the flaws in the book, but maybe also the flaws in you that enjoyed the book.
Oh.
You don't get the same satisfaction. I'm going to brandish my copy of Catcher in the Rye across the studio because I loved it when I read it again last week.
Oh, so you embraced your flaws and Salinger's flaws as well?
The whole heap.
Okay, yeah. So the scenario with me reading it as a teenager, when I wasn't reading Mad Magazine, as I like to talk about all the time in every single episode, because that's where my information about the 20th century came into play, I also did read J.D. Salinger from the comfort of my bright yellow beanbag chair, and I found the whole effect so hip, so cool, all that slanguage in the book. I thought that Holden Caulfield was just so laid back and louche and, you know, kind of a hipster role model. And boy, was I surprised at my change of perspective when I read it again, because I had a whole different impression about it. But I'm going to hold fire on my findings, because we're wheeling in an expert this week. She is a novelist and a podcaster, and in fact has just published her very first young adult novel called All Our Hidden Gifts. Welcome, Carolina Donahue.
So good to be here in this crummy studio.
Oh,
you bunch of phonies.
Oh, I know. crummy. Already we're getting that Holden Caulfield slanguage going on there.
Do you know what? It lives in your head, doesn't it? I find it really hard after reading this book. You do sort of walk around with your hands in your pockets a bit,
yeah,
sort of looking at all these crummy old phonies.
Yeah.
Just and killing you with all the behavior.
Yeah, it really kills me. Yeah, and goddamn before everything. That is the qualifier before anything you say. So, Caroline, your podcast, Sentimental Garbage, is about reevaluating chick lit. So I'm eager to get your perspective on the dick lit that is Catcher in the Rye. Specifically, how the concerns of insecure young men are taken as a little bit more weighty than those of their female counterparts.
It's interesting the sort of the journey that insecure men have gone on in fiction, right? Because it's become somewhat of a cliche now, right? I think if I were doing a podcast on dick lit, I would, you know, you'd start with Catcher in the Rye, wouldn't you? And then you'd make your way through Martin Amis and then to Nick Hornby and run the whole gamut. Where it's interesting now because it's become such a cliche. I often meet a lot of young male novelists, particularly white young male novelists, and they say they feel like they're not allowed to write about their problems anymore because it's become such a cliche, and it's like such a risk to be associated with Holden Caulfield or to be a Holden Caulfield wannabe, which of course Holden would hate.
Can you give us a quick overview of Catcher in the Rye? What do we encounter there?
Of course. So Catcher in the Rye came out in the early 50s and is sort of viewed as being sort of a foundational text of what the sort of young adult experience was like during that time period when, although the term teenager existed for a long time, the sort of sense of a rising majority of people who are consuming a huge amount of pop culture and who were recognised as being in this transitionary period of their lives were beginning to reject sort of traditional values and sort of looking for another way. It's the rise of the Beats, it's all this. But in the middle of this, we've got Holden Caulfield, who's a 16-year-old boy at a Pensy Preparatory School. We meet him on the eve as he's about to be thrown out, or he knows he's been thrown out. His parents don't yet know. And he decides that he's going to have a last hurrah and spend 3 days in New York spending the last of his money, and then he'll sort of go home, hands in pockets, back to mum and dad. And what I want to say then is like, you know, oh, and then things go terribly wrong. But no, things don't go terribly wrong. Holden goes terribly wrong. The whole novel is like watching a sort of a battery-operated toy run out of battery.
He is lost, isn't he, for most of the book. And the strange thing rereading it, Katie, was how little happens, really. Like,
yeah.
If you're plotting a novel and you're thinking of your great narrative arc,
yeah,
you wouldn't plot a book like this where a kid basically leaves a school outside New York, spends 3 or 4 days messing around in New York.
Mm.
I mean, there's no great dramatic beats in there, is there?
No, and also he's just really neurotic. The thing that I think makes it feel modern at all times, like timelessly modern, is how cynical and alienated Holden is. Because I think young people love that idea of that ironic detachment because it's kind of a shortcut to seeming adult. But the thing that strikes me is that for all of his declamations of the world being phony and everything's crummy and nothing is authentic, he's the one that's really the most inauthentic because he won't allow himself to really act on his real emotions. He's quite stunted.
Yeah, you're right. The entire novel, for most of it, is this desperate urge to connect. He was basically paying people to speak to him. Like, he wants to get drinks with cab drivers. You know, it's that classic, I think it's maybe one of the first sort of instances of that now quite cliched thing of like playing a sex worker to talk to you kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
He desperately wants to connect but fails at every hurdle, you know? And I think that's sort of central to the tragedy of the whole thing, really.
How is it perceived at the time? Was it seen as quite revolutionary?
Well, the thing is, it was reviewed well. Like, J.D. Salinger was a exciting writer for a while. People had their eye on him. He, you know, he came from this like very middle class New York background. Like, him and Holden really do share the same childhood. Of this sort of very literary scene. He famously went out with Eugene O'Neill's daughter, Una O'Neill, and was later had her poached by Charlie Chaplin, which is just a mental, that's like a Billy Joel verse in itself, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I mean, talk about, you know, being cock-blocked by one of the founders of cinema.
I know. And it was reviewed well. People liked it. Some people didn't. You can see why it's a little bit Marmite-y and it would be to anyone. But I think the real power of it was that it was written for adults but was adopted by teenagers. And it just, I think it's really one of those things that it hit them at the right time. And it became so popular with teenagers and its literary merit was so kind of clear that, you know, teachers start bringing it into schools. It's this great text to get, you know, young, disaffected kids interested in reading. And then what then starts is the sort of domino effect of it being banned in schools because of its content. And then I think the more controversial it becomes, the more the sort of mystique around it inflates, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in fact, speaking of the censorship, between 1961 and 1982, Catcher in the Rye was the most censored book in high schools and libraries in the United States. And there was a teacher who was briefly fired for assigning it in class. And in 1978, three members of the school board in Washington State alleged that the book was part of an overall communist plot.
Well, Katie, there are 237 instances of goddamn. There's 58 bastards.
Oh.
And there's 31 Christ sakes.
Well,
sounds like a good night out to me.
It sounds like a good night out and probably a good reason to ban it from those impressionable young people.
But what I really enjoy about the controversy bit and the sort of being banned from schools thing is that it does come back to this kind of very common thing that happens. It never goes away of like adults and their opinions of what young people should or shouldn't be reading or listening to or consuming. And this sort of notion that never goes away, that pop culture is eroding the souls of our children. Like for my generation, it was definitely all about Eminem, right? And you know, I remember my parents, like, you know, throwing out every time I brought home a copy of the Marshall Mathers LP. And then, like,
filth.
And, like, you know, there being this sort of great moral crisis over whether or not, you know, Eminem was eroding our souls. And meanwhile, he was writing these very long verses about Bush and the Iraq War. And it's like, well, that's the thing that's really killing your kids. Why can't you, why don't you have the focus for that? And then the same thing happens with Catcher in the Rye, right? Where it sort of gets swept up in a McCarthyism thing as being sort of anti-society, anti-capitalism, and therefore being implicitly communist, right? And it's like constantly trying to wrong foot people in the other direction of like, here's the thing that's eroding your kids, where it's like, no, I think you're eroding the kids, actually. I think war is. I think, you know, all these corrupted political movements. So I find that really fascinating.
I didn't realize it. Effectively, the character's having a nervous breakdown over the course of the whole book, and he's really losing it while the whole time maintaining that it's everybody else's fault. Like, everybody else is crazy and phony and crummy, and I'm the only one, you know. He's almost like a proto-incel because he's very dismissive of women and their wiles, and they're all trying to, you know, pull something over on him, and they're all trying to trick him into something. And of course, that's being a little too harsh, and that's putting a 21st century spin on it, I think. But I do feel like, you know, there's kind of a touch of misogyny going on with him that is really just an expression of how insecure he is. And the only people that he has a real affection and tenderness for are children, like his younger sister or even his younger self. You know, he's very nostalgic for this innocent time.
Yeah. And I do think you're right. There are sort of real evidence of misogyny and that kind of thing. And but there's also what's interesting about Holden is because he is so young and his perspective and his beliefs and things are constantly shifting. And it's that extraordinarily teenage thing of being so sure of what you're saying and thinking in the moment you're saying and thinking of it, and then immediately it changes. So there are all these moments where, like, you could say he's sort of this proto-incel, but there's all these moments of real, like, tenderness and him saying to this guy, you know, I don't think you should say that about a girl if she's nice enough to let you have sex with her. It's like, I don't think you should be talking crap about her. And he sort of, he talks about going on double dates in these sort of like big 50s cars and how the guy in the front will be getting, it's sort of a very, it's very rape culture-y, but it will be sort of trying to get along with the girl and the girl's saying no. And Holden's like, I can't continue when that's happening. That's awful.
Yeah, because he's in the backseat with his girl and, you know, there's like fumbling around and, you know, bra strap tango. It is reading it from the perspective of now, and you're realizing, yeah, it's all about these guys trying to get it off against the will of the young women.
Yeah.
Did you like him? And I know we can't reduce characters in books to whether they are likable, but do you think he is likable? And do you think, because I found that the points I'm most sympathetic to him is when he's talking about Phoebe, his little sister, or Ali, his little brother who's died, and he talks about the baseball mitt and how Ali has written little poems in it and the affection he's got for his big brother, DB. Those were the bits when I felt warmest to him, I think.
You just kind of feel this poor kid, don't you? Like, there's this thing of his little brother who died, and you get the sense that the quite waspy family are being quite stiff upper lip about it, and the mum has her headaches and her nerves, but we don't really get to hear more about that. But then further to that, there's stuff that Holden's keeping even from himself. Like, he has this quite predatory moment with a teacher, and he says, I've had stuff like that happen to me all the time. And then you sort of think, yeah, this kid's been going out of boarding schools for years now, and like we know that, like, oh God, he's been molested, you know, and he pushes all his own trauma onto just passers-by and things he hates and people who are phonies, and he hates the theatre and he hates films, but really it's just this avoidance tactic for all this terrible stuff he's gone through. You feel for him, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. I found him almost affectedly disaffected.
Yes, yes.
It's very performative. There's a section in the book that I think is really indicative of this ongoing tension where he's Always trying to appear more suave than he actually is and kind of man of the world. But then he's questioning himself throughout. So he's on the train and he runs into the mother of a kid that he's in a class with at his prep school. And the mother strikes up a conversation with him and is saying about this boy, Moro. The mother says, well, perhaps he takes things a little more seriously than he should at his age. And he's a very sensitive boy. So Holden goes on to say, sensitive, that killed me. That guy Morrow was about as sensitive as a goddamn toilet seat. I gave her a good look. She didn't look like any dope to me. She looked like she might have a pretty damn good idea what a bastard she was the mother of. But you can't always tell with somebody's mother. I mean, mothers are all slightly insane. The thing is, though, I liked old Morrow's mother. She was all right. Would you care for a cigarette, I asked her. She looked nice smoking. She inhaled it all, but she didn't wolf the smoke down the way most women around her age do. She had a lot of charm. She had quite a lot of sex appeal, too, if you really want to know.
Oh, it's so... But here's the thing is, people get bogged down in how important Catcher is, how it sort of influenced all these murderers, all the mystique around it, that people don't talk about how funny it is.
Yeah.
Like, it's a funny book. Like, his observations are genuinely hilarious, particularly when he points out these sort of little pretensions that you yourself, you know, have noticed, you know, about the way he talks about sort of people going to the theatre and the sort of performative way they enjoy the theatre. Like, you can say that to anybody now and they'd get it, you know?
Yeah.
But the suaveness I find so interesting, and it's the place where I find the sort of the idea that this is a war book that isn't about war thing, is that he's constantly going around and nobody believes him when he says he's convinced he looks old, but no one believes him.
Right.
He's telling everyone he's 25 or 22 and everyone's like, you're 16 and you look 16.
Because he keeps trying to order drinks. And
the ultimate teenage nightmare, isn't it?
I'll just have a Coke, I guess.
Yeah. But to me, that feels like the most... sort of excruciating metaphor for a returning soldier, this thing of like these teenage boys who go to do these horrendous things and are scarred from it so literally, and like the grey hair is a great leftover of that, but that then they come back and they're still children, you know, and they're still perceived as being 19, 20, 21 by society, but they've lived the lives of grown men. We've seen the most traumatic things there. I think that's very affecting.
He says to his daughter at one point, doesn't he, says you never get the smell of burning human flesh out of your nostrils.
Oh, the Salinger said that.
Yeah, Salinger says that to his daughter, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting with him, isn't it? He's like sort of the Greta Garbo of male authors, isn't he? There's this sort of conception around him that he, you know, was an absolute hermit and he didn't want to see anybody, he didn't want any press. But actually, you know, the more biographers look at him, he seems to have lots of very fulfilling relationships in his life with lots of people, was very helpful to lots of young writers. He just didn't want any fame. And that is just completely alien, isn't it, to most people? The idea that someone would write this great thing and not want to be feted publicly about it.
Yeah, and while you write, there's a quote from when he did an interview with the New York Times in 1974. And he says, there is a marvellous peace in not publishing. I love to write, but just for myself and my pleasure.
Yeah.
And that's so counterintuitive for most writers who subconsciously at least want an audience and want their stories to be heard.
Yeah, completely. I do get it, though. I've got this sort of running metaphor in my head that having a book out is a bit like having a dead spouse in that your relationship with that piece of work is over. All the memories that you had together, you and this manuscript, are done. But now everybody else has a relationship with it. So you become the living conduit to the dead thing. And everyone's like, we loved your husband. And you're like, well, you didn't know him, not like I did. And I think Salinger was the ultimate dead spouse novelist. It's like, you don't know Holden. I don't want to hear about how you love my husband.
There are problematic aspects of his interactions and relationships with women. Apparently, he was very controlling with his wife, Claire, and he isolated her from her friends. He also very famously had a relationship at age 53 with the 18-year-old writer Joyce Maynard after he wrote fan letters to her.
Yeah, it's a rough talk, isn't it?
Yeah, what was the score there?
I guess it turns out famous and influential men love young women.
Yeah.
Strange, isn't it?
But I do also think, and I'm not looking to be an apologist for these like slightly predatory relationships, and And I also don't want to speak for those women's experience either, because for all I know, they've had very, you know, rich and foundational moments with this man. So who knows? But I will say there is a popular kind of theory that people stop evolving past their own point of trauma. And if we think of Salinger as somebody who had very serious PTSD following his own experience as a young man, I don't really think he matured past 24, 25 in his own mind. And he never wrote anyone who was older than that either. Like Franny and Zoe and the Glass family and for Esme with Love and Squalor, it's all young people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he surrounded himself with young people. It's kind of, but that was also sort of a theory we put on Michael Jackson a lot, right? And Neverland and all that. There was kind of this accepted rhetoric for a while that Michael Jackson had this the trauma of fame came for him and he never evolved past the idea of being sort of 12 years old, and everyone was kind of quite permissive in a society-wide thing of like, oh, he's just a sort of grown child, you know? So I would wonder if there was some of that going on with Salinger as well.
Katie, we've learnt so much. I'm going to get a towel. I'm going to fan you. You can fan me while we have some adverts.
Hello there. This is my friend Joe.
Hi.
Now, Joe plays rugby for England.
Yeah, what's your point? Come on.
Well, Joe presents a podcast and it's my firm belief that you should listen to it.
Very interesting.
And here's why. Because it's not actually a rugby podcast because, well, let's face it, there's billions of them already.
No. It's about you, the listener, and the jobs you do. If you're a teacher, an astronaut, a tree surgeon or a chef, then we've got loads of questions for you.
The Joe Marler Show. Because everyone is interesting if you ask the right questions.
That's a great line. That is a very good line from you, Tom.
Thank you, Joe. You want to find it? Search for The Joe Marler Show in your podcast app.
Because everyone is interesting if you ask the right questions.
We were talking about how Holden Caulfield is lost as a character. And it does seem like Salinger was a seeker as well. And throughout his life, he was a Zen Buddhist. That happened after the war. And then he was also into various isms yes. that he would enlist his wife. Like, you know, OK, this week we're doing this. You got to study up on this crazy cult. And one of the things that he got involved in, I was interested to see, was the organ accumulators, which are also known as sex boxes, made by Wilhelm Reich. Uh-oh. And I'm showing you guys a photograph of a lady sitting inside the organ accumulator. The organ accumulator, the idea was you'd sit naked inside this telephone booth-sized box.
It's basically a box, isn't it, Katie? It looks like you're shutting someone in a cupboard for being naughty.
Yes, there's a little window in the naughty cupboard. And you sit in this naughty cupboard naked and you just let your vibes accumulate. And apparently...
is that what we're doing right now?
Yes.
Accumulating similar, vibes in our small little room together.
Did we not tell you about that?
Oh, we're taking your vibe. We're stealing your essence.
The idea is that you gather your cosmic and sexual energy, and it can cure colds, it can cure cancer, it can cure impotence.
Oh.
So Salinger had one of these organ accumulators.
Such a great name. Be a great name for a band, actually, organ accumulators.
It's so 80s, isn't it? Yeah. So new romantic.
So, you know, I don't know.
The organ accumulators.
That could have possibly... I don't know if it led to his writer's block. Well, in fact, he didn't have writer's block. He just didn't publish his books. But he was a quirky guy, shall we say.
Certainly a quirky guy.
You also wonder if he was so private and he was writing for himself, how he felt about the mass market success of his book.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many copies it really sold, but you hear stories that it still sells a million copies a year.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary, isn't it? And then how he would feel about the way that his book is taken up by a couple in particular of lunatics, how it's taken up by Mark Chapman, who shoots John Lennon, how it's taken up by John Hinckley, who makes an assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan when he's president. I mean, Chapman has, the day that he goes to the Dakota building in New York, he has bought another copy. He's had copies before. He buys a fresh copy of Catcher in the Rye and famously writes inside it to Holden Caulfield from Holden Caulfield, which is...
It's chilling, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're the author who's written that book...
And he writes, this is my statement. like as if it's his manifesto.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, there's another serial killer, very popular amongst the serial killer demographic. Robert John Bardo was carrying the book when he murdered the actress Rebecca Schaefer in 1989. He famously walked up to her front door in Beverly Hills and killed her. And what do you think it is about Catcher in the Rye that's so inspiring to people who want to snuff out the lives of others?
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because I think the most tempting way to view that whole thing is like, oh, it's a haunted book. Like, it's a possessed text,
cursed.
You know? It's a cursed text. Then when you read it, it's quite a, you know, there's nothing really that persuasive about killing people. And especially he's quite a pacifist, is Zara Holden. Like, he's quite, you know, affectionate. And I think what it actually has more to say about, really, is how when people are missing the infrastructure to help them with their own mental illnesses, how frequently they'll turn to pop culture as a sort of a balm kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
I think people also like making the connection more and more. There's a couple of people who are like, and Catcher in the Rye was in his home.
Which, if you sell a million copies a year, it might be.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Totally. It goes right back to the heart of the song that we're talking about, where it's the century where we're all just fostered by pop culture and less and less by, you know, infrastructure, by the army, by sort of this kind of a rigid schooling system or a rigid moral code. When all that falls away and all that's left is books, movies and music, you know, it's quite interesting.
It's one of the century. Know? It's a choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
It can go either way.
I think what's so interesting about Catcher as well is that it's been sort of preserved in amber. Like, I'm looking at you both with your copies now, and it's the exact same copy, right? It's the red and white sort of Penguin Classics edition, and that's the only copy I've ever really seen in the UK. But a movie was never made, famously. So there's no sense of that manuscript becoming despecialed by, you know, a young Leonardo DiCaprio or a young John Cusack or a young Marlon Brando as Holden Caulfield. There's no film tie-in. There's no, like, IMDb profile. And it sort of gets frozen in its own classic status. It remains cult because pop culture hasn't infected it or something.
Why do you think that people have never succeeded in actually making a film out of it?
Well, first, he never relinquished the rights because he was so distaste for the movie industry, as is very clear in Catcher itself. But I think what I love about the fact that Catcher was never a movie and probably will never be a movie is I like that famous people want something they can't have. Like, I read this interview, this quote with John Cusack, where he said he cried the day he turned 21 because he knew he was too old to play Holden Caulfield. And I was like, good, you can't have it. But what I also love about it is that because people can't use the text itself, people take the spirit of the text and make movies that are very like it. Like, so Igby Goes Down, if anyone's seen that movie, starring Kieran Culkin, which is basically as close to that as you could get. Rushmore, which is an early Wes Anderson movie, is so clearly inspired by Catcher in the Rye, down to the fact that the character is the manager of the fencing team.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And so you get all these little, like, inspiration flashpoints in all these great movies that, because they're not literal adaptations of Catcher in the Rye, get to stand by themselves, but get to sort of bow their head to this great work, you know?
Yeah, the best of all worlds.
Yeah.
Apparently, Salinger felt that he was the only person who could play Holden Caulfield. And incidentally, he was an actor.
Was he?
Yeah,
in
his childhood. And so that was really another reason why he just thought, well, it's not going to be Jerry Lewis. It's not going to be one of those Hollywood phonies. It's got to be me or no one.
Yeah, but I would absolutely hate the idea of, like, a Timothée Chalamet or a Ezra Miller or a Harry Styles, you know, turning it into this sort of this kind of glossy matinee moment, you know?
Maybe it's those great books, the books that you most perfectly realise an interior vision of the world, that are the hardest ones to film, because everyone will be slightly offended by the version that they're given.
Yeah.
A bit like Catch-22, which is a different book, but a lot of people would associate with it. The film of that is nowhere near as good as a book, is it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no one who's talking about Catch 22 is ever talking about the movie.
No one talks about Art Garfunkel in Catch 22, do they?
Yeah. Oh,
well, art does.
All the time.
Non-stop.
The cultural commentator David Reisman in 1961 was trying to explain the book's appeal at a talk in Japan, and this is what he told the Japanese. Boys are frustrated because they aren't cowboys, and girls are frustrated because they aren't boys. He went on to say, women, he's a sociologist, so he says, women
wow.
have been the audience for American fiction and for movies. There are no girl stories comparable to Catcher in the Rye. Yet girls can adapt themselves and identify with such a book, while a boy can't so easily identify with a girl, he reckons. He goes on to say that in the literary marketplace, readers aren't turned off if the characters are male, but only if they're female. After all, how many Boy Scouts and Explorer Scouts have been moved by reading The Bell Jar?
Yeah. Wow.
So this was 1961. He's saying basically, sorry, ladies, boys are automatically the stand-in for all of your emotions and worldview and insecurities, but the favor doesn't go the other way.
Yeah, and that's a constant thing, I think, with all sort of media, right? That like, and particularly in film, where we're sort of, women are expected to relate to male characters, but very seldomly is a male audience expected to go see a movie with women in it. You know?
And is there are there that many movies that have women in it who are the hero, who are on a quest, who are searching for meaning in their life or identity? So, yeah, I mean, I think in a way, the fact that Holden is so kind of at sixes and sevens in his quest, because he's not even sure what his quest is. Is he quitting school? Is he going to a new school? Or, you know, is he going to go and throw himself on the mercy of his parents? He doesn't know. So I guess I got to say, in a way, it is kind of a universal problem that both young men and young women can relate to.
I'm interested in what you guys think is like, so we sort of know because of that last chapter in the end that he, you know, he ends up in a sort of a psychiatric hospital. He's about to be shipped off to yet another school, which makes my heart break. It's like, this kid should not be sent to school after school.
Let him live at home for a bit.
Let him live at home. Yeah. Let him hang out with Phoebe for a while.
Oh,
you know,
please.
For the love of God. What do you think happens to old Holden?
That's a really
good
question.
Does he get drafted for Vietnam? You know, like, what's the deal?
Does he ever solve his problems? As he matures and becomes a bit older, does he ever look back at himself and think, I was clueless, but I've learned? Is he driving a Cadillac with big fins? is he working some phonies job in advertising or something with his waspy background?
I think what he does is he fails upward.
Yeah.
And there's family connections. He's got a really bougie family. And he continues his very storied career as an alcoholic, because he is very fond of the old Winky Blinky juice, as we learn from his many late nights in various piano bars. So I think he becomes a hopeless alcoholic.
Do you think he ever gets together with Jane? Do you think he ever calls Jane?
I kind of want to read Jane's book, honestly.
Do you think Jane cares about him? Or does she feel the same way about Holden as he feels about
her? I think, that tale as old as time, like, girl keeps a male friend on the leash for, just yanks it every couple of years. Whenever Jane's feeling a bit low, she give Holden a ring. Do you know what I mean? Until she eventually gets married. But yeah, I was very arrested by that passage towards the end of the book where he's talking to his teacher. I don't know, it's very kind of foreshadowing moment of like, you're going to be one of those guys that sits in a bar and hates anyone who comes in and looks like they play football in high school. Or you're going to be one of those guys that sits in an office and hates the stenographer. But either way, it's all going to be you sitting around hating people. And he's like, no, I don't hate people that much, I swear. It's just, it really breaks my heart that bit, you know?
You know what? You're so right, Caroline. That is the one bit where I think we do see the author making a pronouncement about the character. Because really, for the most part, I agree with you, Tom, that we're just in the character's head and we're really in his skin and in his world. But I think that's the one bit where we pull away for a wide shot and we can see a projection.
True. What would you say the legacy of Catcher in the Rye is, Caroline, today?
It's interesting because I think it would still be a foundational sort of book in anyone starting a young adult library in a shop or anything, right? But I do think that it's interesting because I remember the first time I saw The Godfather And I was in my 20s, but I had seen every single Simpsons episode ever made, right? And so all these sort of like, I was like, oh, that's the Fat Tony reference. Do you know what I mean? And so I think even teenagers who are big readers, because so many things have come after Catcher who that have sort of used that voice and used that sort of way of telling a story in the same way, I think they would read Catcher now and think, oh, Fat Tony, you know, rather than...
So in a way, it would almost lose the impact because in the way that when you see Star Wars...
It inspired so much.
Yeah, you see Star Wars now and you think, well, that we've seen that done over and over and done better. And,
yeah.
You know, because you weren't there at the beginning when it was completely extraordinary and sui generis, you know, just absolutely stood on its own.
I had this experience recently where I finally picked up Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain and I was like... R.I.P. to this man, but this is dull as shit. I was like, I have no, like, him just being the bad boy of the kitchen. I was like, I was so self-aggrandizing. I was so bored. And everyone was like, yes, but you have to understand that the bad boy of the kitchen wasn't a cliche when he was doing it. I was like, oh, okay. You kind of do have to remember that with things like Catcher. Anything that goes on to have this great life and inspires so much that comes after it, you do have to have that slightly forgiving backwards glance, don't you? Sorry to the Bourdain family.
Caroline, thanks so much for coming on We Didn't Start the Fire.
Thank you so much for having me. I love this podcast and I love the song it's based on, so delighted
feel
to be here.
Feel free to sing it as you leave the studio. We always do.
What's so...
Don't laugh at me whistling in a jaunty fashion.
I wish I could whistle this well. What's so nice, it must be nice for you guys as well, is you guys have done enough episodes that when you're scrolling through the podcast, it's like North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn
Monroe.
It's so much fun just to scroll through.
And don't forget Studebaker.
Katie, as always when we do this show, I find myself wondering what Billy was thinking. And sometimes you think, did Billy really know that person and that place? But with Catcher in the Rye, he's a kid growing up in New York. He's a young boy. He's a creative type. I think it's quite a natural fit for him, isn't it?
He has a well-thumbed, if not positively dog-eared, copy of Catcher in the Rye in his boyhood shelf. So when he's not practicing his scales at the piano or he's not down at the gym... practicing his punches.
Or watching the baseball because he loves his baseball.
Yeah, he loves his baseball. So when he's not doing all of those things, he is practicing being a disaffected, alienated, too cool for school teenager. I think probably young Billy was more earnest than Holden Caulfield, but that's what he's aiming for, is hipness.
And all those bars that Holden Caulfield goes to where people are tinkling the ivories, Billy would find himself in those very same places because he is the piano man.
You made a very, very compelling case there for why Billy included Catcher in the Rye. So yeah, thumbs up to Billy. What are we going to be enjoying next week, Tom?
I believe, Katie, it's Eisenhower, President Dwight Eisenhower of Eisenhower fame.
Okay. And if you're in the mood for even more podcasts, can I recommend to you, listeners, a little something called Alan Cumming's Shelves. You can join actor Alan Cumming as he takes an artifact off his extensive shelves and tells you the story behind it with a little help from some friends.
Katie, he's spoken to Sir Ian McKellen about a dog collar, Cyndi Lauper about a pair of leather gloves. You'll even get to hear Jerry Halliwell talk about Alan's Spice Girls lunchbox.
I don't know if I want to know about Alan's Spice Girls lunchbox or what's in it. The stories are hilarious, and there's so many fantastic guests coming on to help Alan tell the tales of his life. So please do check it out. Just search for Alan Cumming Shelves on your podcast app.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th-century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th-century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.